It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in today for Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show. Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! That's...
This Sunday marks the 50th anniversary of one of the most important musical performances of all time, when the Beatles took the stage on The Ed Sullivan Show on February 9th, 1964. Popular music would forever be changed, and a wave of Beatlemania swept the United States.
And at the time, no one could have predicted what would come next for the Fab Four. Now in 2014, 50 years after the band first took America by storm, the Beatles are considered by many to be the greatest rock and roll band of all time, and their influence can be heard in music today.
Joining us now to talk about the legendary performance and the musical legacy of the Beatles is John Kovach. He's a professor and rock historian at the University of Rochester, and he's teaching a free online course called The Music of the Beatles on the website Coursera. John, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
That clip is something else. I love hearing Ed Sullivan, I guess, saying some youngsters from Liverpool. You can't imagine. It's the Beatles we're talking about there. But what was riding on this Ed Sullivan gig?
Well, I mean, if managers could figure out how to do what happened to the Beatles in early 1964, they would have done it over and over and over again. But it turned out to be a great coordination of talent, of personal charisma that the Beatles had. I mean, they were a very charismatic bunch of guys in a way that was really refreshing in this country at the time, and a kind of coincidence of a number of different business deals that had been started as early as September of 1963, when the Beatles were totally unknown in this country and couldn't get their records played on the radio anywhere.
Now was another thing beyond the business deals the fact that the Beatles showed up right after a pretty large national tragedy, the death of President Kennedy. I mean, do you think that that contributed to the Beatles being such a success?
Well, I think partially. I mean, we could say that perhaps the country was ready for some good news and for something to kind of lose itself in. But it's not entirely clear that it should have been something having to do with music. And if it was going to have to do with music, it's not entirely clear why it should have been the Beatles, a group from not just England but Liverpool, places that had never really produced sustained success in terms of musical acts in this country. So even the Kennedy thing, there may be a certain amount of receptivity that was there, but why it should have been these particular guys and why they should have been a rock band, the Kennedy part of it doesn't explain that.
Now, you mentioned the business deals. What kind of deals did they have?
Through 63, if the Beatles had never made it in the U.S., they would have always been remembered in the history of British popular music for the success they had in 63, which in many ways convinced not only British musicians but fans alike that British groups could be as good as or even better than American groups. Up to that point, for the last couple of decades preceding it, since the Second World War, everybody in the U.K. really thought American pop was the best. And even those British homegrown groups, with only a few exceptions, were mostly imitating what the Americans were doing. But in 63, with the rise of the Beatles, that was viewed as music that came from their own home shores, even though it was very much influenced by American pop. And their overwhelming success in 63, really convinced people that, gosh, maybe British groups can be as good as American groups. But in spite of all that success, Brian Epstein could not figure out a way to get the band attention in the United States. They tried to release a couple of records. The first two ended up being rejected by Capitol. A U.S. subsidiary of their label in the U.K., EMI and Parlophone. Please, Please Me and From Me to You were both released by VJ. They went nowhere. Then they switched to Swan in September of 1963 with She Loves You. It went nowhere. They went with Swan partially because it was a Philadelphia-based label that Dick Clark used to be involved in before the Payola scandals, and they hoped maybe that connection might get the record on American Bandstand, and it did, but it only rated a 73, and DJ stopped playing it, you know, and so he was just beside himself. And so the way it worked is that United Artists had an office in London, and they had both the movie division and the record division, and there were guys who were working in London who saw this British success the Beatles were having. And so one of them was somehow able to look into the Beatles' contract with EMI and saw that it didn't say anything specific about soundtrack albums. So they proposed to Brian Epstein that they do a movie with the Beatles in order to get the soundtrack album that they could then release. So the movie could have lost money.
So was this sort of a
soundtrack?
Is this sort of a prototype music video we're talking about?
Well, you know, movies, quick, fast and quick rock movies sort of go all the way back to Elvis and Alan Freed back in the 1950s. And so it was easy to sort of throw something together, you know, with a flimsy plot and a bunch of performances, basically to act as an advertisement to try to sell the records. So A Hard Day's Night was actually signed before the Beatles had any success in the United States. At the same time, Sid Bernstein, a New York City promoter, had been trying to get a hold of Brian Epstein to book him into book the group into Carnegie Hall in February. And Ed Sullivan's UK talent scout, a fellow by the name of Peter Pritchard, had been sending Ed clippings of all that had been going on with the Beatles in the UK. And so Peter Pritchard put Brian Epstein in contact with Sullivan's people. He was in New York in early November 63, signed the Beatles to an unprecedented three shows in a row on the Ed Sullivan Show in February, locked down the Carnegie Hall gigs in the course of December and January, also booked an extra show in Washington, D.C. as a kind of warm-up show. And still they had no real airplay in this country until a DJ in Washington, D.C. by the name of Carol James started playing the record on Washington, D.C. radio before it was WWDC, before it had ever been released in this country. He got a copy because a young listener by the name of Marcia Albert had asked for it as a request, and their policy back in AM radio those days was to honor every request from a listener. He had a friend who was a stewardess on BOAC Airlines who could bring over a British copy. They played it on the radio, and all of a sudden the tune started to break out in the Washington, D.C. market.
So basically it was a little bit of business acumen and a little bit of luck.
Well, yeah. I mean, who would have known that just to sort of put in question the idea of music industry wisdom, in early December, when an imported copy of I Want to Hold Your Hand started to break out in the Washington, D.C. market capital, because they weren't planning to release the record until the middle of January, Brian had finally talked them into releasing it, they actually hired a lawyer to send a cease and desist letter to the Washington station to try to get them to stop playing their record.
So don't you think, though, that the Beatles were going to be huge no matter what happened, no matter how they broke? If they didn't break huge on the Ed Sullivan Show, they would have broken anyway.
Well, it certainly seemed to be happening that way when that record started to go viral, first in D.C., then Chicago and St. Louis. I mean, it went so viral that Capitol stopped trying to sue the station and moved the release date up to who would ever release a single on December the 26th? But that's what they did because it was the first date they could get those records in the stores to take advantage of this. By the last week of January, the record was number one on the cash box charts. By the first week of February, it was number one on the Billboard charts as well. And on February the 9th, they were playing on Ed Sullivan. What kind of timing is that? And then after that, they already had a movie deal, and they had a movie in the theaters by July of 1964. I mean, that's some kind of luck.
So they kind of hit big. They were lucky to have a lot of things in place, although I'm sure there were a lot of pop acts back in those days that did that. Why do you think and I guess just their success, their initial success is exciting. But then after that, they sort of took it to a new level. This wasn't just like a pop band that hit it big. They seemed to go beyond that. What do you think it is about the Beatles that allowed them to do that?
Well, as I was just saying, they had the opportunity, but they also had the goods. I mean, they were a fantastic group. They had this wonderful composing team, songwriting team of John Lennon and Paul McCartney. and all this charisma and all this ability as singers. I mean, John and Paul were both good enough singers to have had their own solo careers, you know, and here they are singing together along with George Harrison. I mean, what a combination of talent. The opportunity presented itself. They never really were satisfied without sort of moving forward. And so one of the great things about the Beatles is that they outlived the fad. I mean, initially they were a fad. They outlived the fad that brought them to fame. And a lot of groups didn't. Jerry and the Pacemakers, Herman's Hermits, the Dave Clark Five were pretty much gone when the British invasion was over. But the Beatles.
And we're going to hit pause right now as we talk with John Kovach about Beatlemania. We're coming up on the 50th anniversary of the band's breakout performance on The Ed Sullivan Show. And we want to hear from you on this. Do you remember seeing the performance on TV? Did you experience Beatlemania? Do you understand it? It seems like it was over the top and we haven't really seen the like since. Why do you think that was? What was it about the Beatles that brought it on? 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'd like to hear what you think about the Beatles, or maybe they never did anything for you. We'd love to hear that as well. 1-800-642-1234. You can join the conversation right after the break. But first, here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold. We're celebrating 50 years of Beatlemania this afternoon. 50 years. Do you believe that? The Beatles, they first started making a big splash in America 50 years ago. And a Beatles expert is here with us today, rock historian John Kovach. And we'd love to hear from you, too. What are your favorite memories of the band from the last 50 years? Why do you like the Beatles? We'd love to hear from you. Join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. The phones are on fire, so I think we're just going to go straight to a call. Glennis from Duran called. Glennis, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. What's your story?
Yeah. Well, I guess my Beatles story was when I was in high school, a friend of mine, we got together and we got a ride into Chicago. And we went to what was the amphitheater and watched the Beatles perform. And it was just a wonderful, great concert. And it was something I'll always remember.
Now, when you saw it, did you have a sense that the Beatles were going to be a group that people would be talking about many years later?
Oh, yes, I did. I mean, the place was just packed. And everybody was so excited after, you know, they had been on Ed Sullivan. And you know, it was a big thing. And everybody thought that they were just the greatest, I guess.
Now, did you just like the Beatles at the beginning, or did you sort of go through the whole transition? You know, I mean, did you as they changed their musical styles and stuff, did you stick with them the whole time?
I guess I did. I think I liked some of their music better than others, but I still am a huge fan of their music.
Well, thanks so much for that call, Glennis. We really appreciate it. John Kovach, I'm sure you hear a lot of stories like that as you talk to people about the Beatles.
Yeah, and, you know, with younger people who didn't experience that time, you know, they probably have to be told that those Beatles concerts only lasted about 30 minutes. And most of the time, you couldn't hear very much of what they were actually playing because people were screaming the whole time. But so I think that in many ways, memories are shaped by the just intense emotional reaction to seeing the group, because you couldn't really hear them very long, and you couldn't hear them for a very long time, and you couldn't hear them very well amidst all the yelling and screaming.
I'm going to call. I think might speak to that. Let's go next to Tom joining us in Richmond, Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, so I was 10 years old when they played the Ed Sullivan Show, and I was kind of a contrarian back then. I decided I didn't like them, and so it was just too much screaming. I walked away from the TV and found something else to do. But later on, when Rubber Soul showed up in our house, I realized they were pretty good after all, and I've liked them ever since.
So you came around eventually, but it was too much in the beginning for you. And let's talk about that a little bit, John. The screaming at these concerts, was that normal? Did it stay that way the whole time?
Well, I mean, they stopped touring in the summer of 66 because it just got too crazy, and they were tired of it and all that. But, you know, the screaming goes back. I mean, we can talk about Frank Sinatra and the Bobby Soxers back in the 40s or the screaming over Elvis in the 50s. With the Beatles, it was more intense, and the music business was built up to exploit it more by the 1960s. But, by the time they stopped touring and started to become a recording band, they really became a different kind of group. They were no longer pop idols, but now more like rock artists.
Well, it was interesting. Our caller, and I'm sorry, I forget its name, but he mentioned how he was kind of a contrarian. Did the Beatles change their musical style because they were kind of bored with it too?
Yeah, the story I usually tell is that, you know, between A Hard Day's Night, which is the epitome of their pop song craftsmanship, and Sgt. Pepper, which is kind of the epitome of their artistic, exploratory, experimental kind of phase. There's only 3 years difference, the summer of 64 to the summer of 67. Boy, that's a very fast stylistic change curve. You know, you can look at Rubber Soul and Revolver and see it happening, but boy, that's an awful lot of change.
Okay, let's go back to the phones, and we have Don joining us in Ontario, Wisconsin. Hi, Don.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to say, for me at least, I think one of the attractions of the Beatles was they weren't this sort of little narrow romantic formula like the American pop songs that came immediately before them. They were talking about, you know, they put it in humorous terms, but, you know, real people, real, like, neighborhood and domestic situations, you know, somebody running away from home and a meter maid and, you know, uncles, and just, it was almost like a community, you know, the characters in their songs. It's almost like a little mini Shakespeare or something. You had such a range of personalities.
Thanks a lot, Don. So Don's getting it, sort of the slice of life quality that a lot of the Beatles songs had, instead of sort of a generic She Loves You, Shooby-Doo, like the 50s stuff.
Very much under the influence of Dylan. He's the one who really prompted John and Paul to get away from the teen love lyrics into something a little bit more sort of serious and what we would call sort of authentic these days.
And speaking of Dylan, Peter from Appleton, you want to weigh in a little bit? I think you have a story about Bob Dylan.
Sure. Well, I think you may have just answered the question. I had heard that when Dylan met the Beatles, that Dylan told them that they really had nothing to say, and this really shook John up. And I wondered if that was true, that he changed his music after talking with him.
Well, they were already big fans of Dylan, and I think it's good to remember that Dylan didn't become really a high-profile solo performer until the summer of 1965. So when the Beatles met Dylan in New York in fall of 1964, probably August of 64 is the meeting you mean, you know, you pretty much had to be a folk aficionado to have Dylan records. And they did. They had them and they admired them. So when they met Bob, you know, they were bigger stars than he was, but they very much admired him. And so what he said made a difference.
So they were kind of like hipsters then.
They wanted to be songwriters, and Bob is a fantastic songwriter, and so they admired the craft in his lyrics.
Were they ever rivals like, say, Simon and Garfunkel and Dylan seem to have been, or did they get along, Dylan and the Beatles?
Yeah, I think they did get along. I mean, of course, Pete Seeger would have accused Dylan of being too influenced by the Beatles by taking up an electric guitar at the Newport Folk Festival in the summer of 65. Mm-hmm. And clearly, you know, both John and Paul were very influenced by Dylan. I mean, right after the meeting with that, all of a sudden the big acoustic guitars start to come out, and we've got, you know, Hey, You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, which if that isn't John Lennon doing Bob Dylan, I don't know what is.
And Bob Dylan was in a band with George Harrison later in life, too.
The Traveling Wilburys, right, with Roy Orbison and Jeff Lynne and Tom Petty.
All right. We're talking about the Beatles today on Central Time, and you're welcome to join the conversation. The number again is 1-800-642-1234. Let's go to Randy from Middleton. Randy, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, good afternoon. I have to take sort of general exception with the professor, because I always thought the big break in the songwriting was between the invasion, you know, in January, the time, and the soundtrack to Hard Day's Night, which I found to be actually pretty darn sophisticated. And sure, it's pop, but I think that's when I started thinking about these guys as very, really serious songwriters.
Okay. Thanks, Randy. What about that? Did the evolution really speed up when we got to Hard Day's Night?
Well, I think that A Hard Day's Night is in many ways the epitome of their pop song craftsmanship, but also has many of the ingredients in embryo form that are going to turn into the more artistic approach. And if I had the guitar and we had more time, I could dig into If I Fell and A Hard Day's Night and show you how there are all kinds of little musical details in there that get worked out in ways that are more sophisticated than you would find in your average pop tune.
John, do you think we'll ever see another band that hits it this big, that people are this crazy for, that kind of mania for a rock band? Is it possible today?
Gosh, I don't know. Part of that had to do with how focused the entertainment business was back in those days. I mean, the night that Ed Sullivan played, there were only two other channels you could be watching TV, you know. And now everything, because of the Internet, what's great is that anybody can release a CD and get it out there on the Internet. But the problem is everybody is releasing a CD, and the audience is so fragmented. How do you get them all together? I mean, Bruno Mars had a pretty big audience, maybe the biggest in television history at the Super Bowl. But I don't think that was the Ed Sullivan show for him.
John, I want to thank you so much for joining us and revisiting this time in history.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to John Kovach, a rock historian, professor at the University of Rochester.
Coming up next, we'll find out what a weaker-than-expected jobs report means for the economy and for your money on the stock market. I'm Mike Arnold, filling in for Rob Ferret.
I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Say that song, girl. I want to hold your hand.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Mike Arnold, and for Rob Ferret, you're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out how to ward off winter's chill with some homemade herbal tea.
But first, the latest economic report. We'll take a look at the latest job numbers and find out what we can expect from our new Fed chair, Janet Yellen.
New unemployment figures were released today, and while the jobless rate has edged down somewhat, we saw fewer than expected jobs added to the payrolls last month.
We've asked Marketplace Money Economics editor Chris Farrell to explain what's going on. Chris, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me. I'll try to explain this.
Well, so let's start with the job report. Now, the jobless rate has improved a bit, but the numbers today, they're lower than expected. What happened?
So this is, you know, if you take a look at this report, I think there's a story to be emphasized, and it's been going on for a considerable period of time. The private sector job growth was 142,000. The overall number was 113,000. Private sector job growth was 142,000. That's not what people were hoping for. People were hoping, you know, around a little over 180,000. But it was 29,000 cuts in government, federal, state, and local across the board. And the story of this economy has been over a period of time, as we've been improving, as you're starting to see some better gross domestic product numbers, that the private sector has been growing, not fast, but it is growing, and it is the public sector to a large extent, with the cuts going on in the public sector jobs, that is holding back this job growth figure.
Now, there were some bright spots, manufacturing and construction. Now, they were up. Why there? Is there a pattern emerging?
Well, I think in terms of there are two things going on. One, you know, in manufacturing, there's something going on in this country as far as manufacturing goes. And I was off here locally, Dunwoody. It's a technical college, and they're training just many workers for the manufacturing sector, and they're getting a job right away. So manufacturing, you can't exaggerate it, but manufacturing is going through a revival. The big issue about the manufacturing revival here is that it's adding the jobs, but not that many. But nonetheless, manufacturing is going through a revival. And then with the construction, it's a combination of factors. I think part of it is the improvement in the housing market that's showing up in more houses being opened up. And then there's just a lot of other construction going on, you know, in terms of building stadiums or other things. So construction seems to be doing a little bit better. Developers seem to be spending a little bit more money, and it's reflecting some optimism in the housing market.
So do we have a sense of why the public sector, government jobs are lagging?
Well, you know, a lot, it's showing up, you know, one of the areas that people were a little bit surprised about was healthcare was down and education was down. Particularly the healthcare was actually quite a large number, and that's sort of unusual. And you can't pin that on all the turmoil that's going on with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. In fact, you'd actually think there'd be more hiring because of all the uncertainties going on there. So that was one thing that, that people noticed. And I think with a lot of state and local governments, it's a lag effect. A lot of, you know, the, as you know, a lot of governments have been going through a period of time of just really tough budgets. They cut back a lot. They did a lot of the, most of the work was on the spending side. They reduced their headcount. Now the flow, you know, the revenues are increasing. There's a lot of capital gains going on. There are more incomes and a lot more state and local governments are starting to deal with surplus, but I think that there's a lag in terms of their spending it. So we're still seeing the cuts. My expectation is this is one of the more positive factors that will go on in this economy as 2014 continues, which is that there can be less cuts in the state and local government side, and actually we might start seeing some hiring.
So that could stabilize things. But
yes.
Today, the headlines were generally, you know, the numbers were lower, so maybe this economy, this economic recovery was not as solid as we think, not as durable as we think. Do you think it's too early to be worrying about things like that?
Well, it's, you know, it was interesting going through some of the comments. You know, the positive comments were, this isn't a catastrophe. This isn't a disaster. And I think what this is basically what this economy has been doing. We still have job growth. It's disappointing job growth. Not a whole lot has changed. And what, and I think where a lot of the disappointment's really coming in, not just because the number is low, but, you know, toward the end of 2013, as we were in that period of October, November, December, there was a growing sense that this economy was really starting to gain some traction. The private sector was starting to grow. So we came to 2014 thinking, okay, finally, we're going to start getting some job growth. I mean, look at this stock market. It's up 166%, 170% actually, since its low of 2009. You know, companies are going to start spending this cash. We're going to get some mergers and acquisitions. State and local governments are doing better. And so relative to what the expectations were, this is a real dash. This is a real dose of cold water on expectations. As far as the economy goes, I think that is, we are basically stuck in the same rut of, you know, slightly better than 2% generates positive job growth, but nothing to get excited about.
Now, you mentioned the Affordable Care Act, and this has been making some headlines as regards jobs. Earlier this week, congressional Republicans talked a lot about a report by the Congressional Budget Office, which they say indicates that Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is bad for jobs. What's the crux of that argument?
Okay, so the crux of that argument is a misinterpretation of the numbers. And the crux of the argument is not that because of the Affordable Care Act, the number that's been out there is 2 million jobs, that the demand by employers is going to shrink by 2 million jobs. That was not what the number said. What the number said is that, look, there are a lot of people who are locked into a job, and they'd actually like to work fewer hours, or they'd like to leave that employer. And so because there's more insurance available and because of the Affordable Care Act, they're going to be working less. They're going to work fewer hours. Now, then you can have a debate. Is this a good or a bad thing? I'm in the camp that says, look, if you want to work fewer hours and you're able to work fewer hours, fine. That's fine. What's wrong with that? Other people say, no, you know, we need people to be working more. But nonetheless, what it really is about people working fewer hours because they have access to health insurance and what they were doing. And the job they had, and maybe they hated it, maybe they didn't like it, but they did it because they didn't want to leave their family naked without any health insurance, so they were sticking it out, gritting their teeth. I think it's actually more of a positive number than a negative one.
So this isn't jobs going up in smoke. This is jobs that people are electing to leave because now they have a different option.
Right. And the way the calculation really is what it is, it's hours going up in smoke because you may not leave a full you may have a full-time job and you move to part-time because you feel comfortable doing that. You still have some income coming in, but you're not as worried about meeting the number of hours that you need to get to be on your employer's health insurance plan.
So moving on to the Fed, on Monday, Janet Yellen was sworn in as the new chair of the Fed, the first woman to serve in that role. How sensitive are the markets to a transition of power like the one we just had when Janet Yellen took over from Ben Bernanke?
Well, I think the markets are very sensitive to it, but they're sensitive to it because it's the Fed. And the Fed is the most powerful economic institution in the world. And that's not exaggeration, that's not hyperbole, that's actually a statement of fact. As far as its transition goes from Bernanke to Yellen, once they settled on Janet Yellen, it's been very smooth. And the perception is there's not going to be a whole great deal of difference, at least up front. So I don't expect any major turmoil on Wall Street reflecting Yellen's testimony, but people will be looking very closely at it. They're going to see, well, what's going to be happening with this tapering, which is with the, you know, the Fed removing slowly its bond buying program. What's she going to be talking about the job market? Is she going to give us any markers? But I expect that, you know, she's very professional. She's extremely well practiced in Washington. So if we're talking today, the expectation is no bombshells. We'll see what happens next week.
Okay, so you mentioned the tapering of the bond buying. That's having an effect already in some places, isn't it? What are we seeing?
So we're the tapering is, this is the quantitative easing, which is, you know, the Fed's been having this unusual policy of buying bonds to help bring down interest rates, help out the housing market, encourage people to go more into the equity market, try to support the economy. They recognize at some point we got to stop doing this. So it's been $85 billion, then it's down to $75 billion. Now they're going to do $65 billion. And they're just going to gradually reduce this presence in the market, which should raise interest rates. That's the expectation. Not a big run-up in interest rates, not a huge run-up in interest rates, but it should, there'll be less buying in the market, so therefore interest rates should rise. That's the expectation. There's an expectation that nothing is going to change right now. They're going to continue the tapering. However, and this is what the Fed has worked really hard to try and convince the markets, and a lot of the turmoil that we had back in May and, you know, after that was they weren't very convincing to the market, but they seem to have finally gotten their message across. They're going to continue the tapering, but they're going to keep interest rates low. And, you know, they're just not going to ease up. They're not going to tighten up on monetary policy anytime soon because you have no worries about inflation. Inflation's barely existent, and you do have worries about the job market. But what they want to do is kind of get rid of this unusual program that they instituted during the worst of the downturn.
Well, Chris, thank you so much for coming back on and explaining it to us today.
Well, I hope that was clear. Thanks a lot.
It was excellent. Thank you. Chris Farrell is the economics editor for Marketplace Money.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Mike Arnold.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Maybe you've heard of making your own beer or making your own cheese, but did you know you could make your own herbal tea? On this Cold Food Friday, we'll find out how you can warm things up a bit using ingredients like fresh ginger and dried elderberries.
Anna Thomas Bates is a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. Her recent article in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section focuses on the healing benefits of herbal tea. Thanks for joining us, Anna.
Pleasure to be back.
So, Anna, when did you start making your own herbal tea?
You know, it's kind of a natural extension from cooking. You put a bunch of things in and make a delicious soup, and you think, why not do this with tea as well? And people have been doing it for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
So, one reason that you're doing it, I guess you mentioned in the article, is it's a good way to sort of fend off colds and other maladies. So what kind of herbs are good to put in your homemade herbal tea?
Sure. Well, just to preface, I'm not a doctor and an herbalist, so definitely talk to someone before you get into this. But there's a lot of, you know, historical and purported benefits of a lot of these herbs, and a lot of them are right in your pantry. Things like all the herbs you use for Italian cooking, oregano, marjoram, thyme, those are supposed to be really good for soothing coughs in your respiratory system. And there's also a number that are just antimicrobial that may fight infection, bacteria, viruses, things like ginger, rosemary, lavender, peppermint's another one. And then a lot of those herbs that you see in a lot of teas and also cooking and curing and preserving foods, and I don't think that's a coincidence, things like cinnamon, cloves, and black pepper.
Now, where are the best places to get these herbs? Are these things that you would just buy from the store, or do you grow them in your yard, or...?
You can do any of those. You know, it's definitely good to seek out a source that is, you know, organic or hasn't been sprayed with pesticides, since you are going to be soaking it in water and drinking it. But a lot of these can be found just in the spice aisle of your grocery store. You know, the things like the cinnamon, the cloves, the black pepper, ginger, fennel, cumin are all really wonderful ones. Others are great to grow in your yard. Mint grows like crazy. You can grow lavender and rosemary and oregano as well. And then for some of the slightly more unusual ones, at the natural food stores like Willie Street Co-op in Madison or Outpost Natural Foods in Milwaukee, they actually have a medicinal herb aisle, and you can buy some of these things in bulk. And of course, online is a really good resource as well.
So how do you figure out which herbs go together?
Yeah, well, you can kind of feel, you know, how do you feel? Do you have a respiratory issue? Do you feel like you have a cold coming on, are you congested, and you can kind of tailor some of the herb's purported benefits to what's ailing you, or you can just go with what tastes good. You know, I really love ginger and lemon and honey, and that kind of makes me feel better no matter what. If I'm tired or feel like I have the flu coming on, you know, some really hot ginger tea really hits the spot.
I think you mentioned in the article that you have children. I mean, when you first started making herbal tea for them, did they react positively to that, or...
Although I've been getting them to taste test all sorts of unusual things since they were very young, so they like lots of different beverages and foods. But, you know, add a little bit of honey, and everything goes down well. And if your child isn't used to just the taste of straight herbal tea, even with a little bit of honey, you can always add a tiny bit of juice as well just to sweeten it up. You know, something like chamomile goes really nice with a little bit of apple juice. They really complement one another, and a little bit of honey. And, you know, even a two-year-old will drink that.
Now there's some herbs and spices that we kind of know what they taste like, but there are some things like, I mean, you know, for example, tree bark, roots, stuff like that. We're not exactly familiar with that taste. How do you, is there a way you could tell us about some of those things that might be worth trying out if you're considering making your own herbal tea at home?
Sure. If you're looking for some more unusual things, I think one of your best bets is elderberry. It's a native plant. You can find it around here. And there's actually some farms like Hilltop Community Farm in Laval that are starting to grow it on a commercial basis. But elderberry supposedly has wonderful immune-boosting properties, and it's a small berry, and you can buy it dried, and you can find this at those natural food stores, or you can buy that online. And that's one that you just soak in water for like 10 to 20 minutes, and it really extracts a lot of that good stuff, and you get this really dark, a little bit tannic, tasting tea. But it's supposed to be really wonderful for your immune system.
Now, have you ever used tree bark in herbal tea?
I have used some roots, but I haven't, besides cinnamon. Cinnamon's actually a bark. I've used licorice root as another one, and actually that's what flavors real licorice, not Twizzlers, but the real deal licorice is actually made with the flavor of licorice root. So that's one that's used a lot in Chinese medicine.
So let's imagine you're sitting there, you got a pile of herbs on the table, you want to make some herbal tea. How do you do this? Do you have one of those tea balls or something that you put it in? Or
you can. Anything that you use to brew loose tea, you can use with these herbs as well. But you don't have to have that. I often just heat up my water to about boiling or just under boiling, and I'll put my herbs in a like a Pyrex glass cup, and I just pour the water right over there and cover it and steep it. And a lot of these things you want to steep a little bit longer than traditional tea to really get out a lot of that good stuff. So 10 minutes is a good number, and you can even go higher than that if it's a berry or a bark, something that's really hard and needs some good soaking time. And people recommend covering it just to keep in all the essential oils and all of that steam in, so it really concentrates the tea. And after that, you can just pour it through a strainer into your glass.
I have a question about this. I mean, there's a lot of herbal tea out there. I mean, you can go to the grocery store and you can just buy a bunch of herbal tea. What's the benefit of making it yourself?
Well, there's two. Depending upon the ingredient, it can be less expensive. But also there's just the customization factor. You can take exactly which herbs you want, which ones you like the best, and you can make up your own blend. So it gives you a lot of diversity, and you can make your own unique blend tailored to you or your family's preferences.
So what would be some of your, I mean, you've sort of alluded to that, but are there some things that you like better than others, or that you suggest other than others? You mentioned the I think, elderberry, but what are some other suggestions you'd make to somebody who's trying this out?
Oh, sure. Well, a really easy one that is nice for soothing the stomach would be a combination of, like, ginger and peppermint. And you could blend those, add a little bit of lemon juice and honey after it's done steeping, and you'd have a real nice stomach-soothing tea that has a really nice scent. Also, you can do your own chai. Chai tea is some popular flavors. That one would have cinnamon, cloves, black pepper, star anise, and you would just steep all that together, and you'd have the flavor of chai.
Now, you mentioned when you were making it that you sort of let it steep in there and stuff, and if you have chunks, I mean, do you strain it or something like that to keep the chunks out?
I do. I pour it through like a fine mesh strainer.
Okay. That's good. Although I guess that would make it kind of fun. It's more homemade that way.
No, I like to strain mine. It would taste, but, you know, you don't want to choke or anything.
So is there anything that you do, you know, in the summer or in the fall to prepare so that you have the right stock of stuff for herbal tea? Or,
well, for the few things that I do grow, I do have mint, oregano, and thyme, and you can dry those. You can harvest them before it frosts, lay them out on a screen, or hang them in a nice dry place. And you can dry them yourself and then just crumble them up and keep them in a jar, and they'll stay good for several months.
Now, this takes a lot longer, so there are probably some people who are a little suspicious, and they say, I can make some herbal tea in a microwave in a couple minutes. I steep it for a few minutes, and I'm done. If you were trying to convince somebody that this was a thing for them to do, what do you think are the main benefits of doing it on your own?
Well, it is fun, and like I said, just the customization. If there's something that you don't like in a certain herbal tea that you would buy that's a little bit bitter, you can take that out, and you can really tailor it to your taste or whatever condition you have that you want to try and alleviate.
And you talked about how you like to experiment with things. Have you ever made, like, a cup of herbal tea that just tasted like garbage?
There are some herbs that you think would taste really good, and they don't. And one of those, I still used it in my recipe, but lemon balm is one of them. I grow it.
Lemon balm?
Lemon balm.
You'd think that would be good, right?
It has a beautiful scent, very lemony. But once you dry it and get it in a cup, it tastes very grassy and a little bitter. But it's supposed to be a very powerful antiviral, so I still like to use it in small amounts, but it just doesn't taste quite as good as you think it would.
Have you ever used onion grass in tea?
I haven't, but someone just came out this year with some savory teas, and one of them I think had. Yeah, I didn't try it, but...
Well, Anna, thanks so much for joining us today. It sounds like a fun thing to do.
Thank you so much.
That was Anna Thomas Bates. She's a freelance writer who blogs at tallgrasskitchen.com. She also writes a weekly column for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's food section.
And we have a tea recipe from our guest for you. It's called Winter Warrior Tea. Imagine just about everybody needs that right now. It includes a lot of yummy stuff. It's got cinnamon, ginger, pepper, and honey. And you can find that recipe on the Central Time Facebook page.